live on Never Had It So Good Sports Radio. A new day brings new topics. Our sports talk brings extensive debate and analysis by the host, expert contributors, and callers. We discuss it all. Join us weekdays at 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. on Never Had It So Good Sports Radio.
Hey, welcome to Never Had It So Good Sports Radio. I am Princess Cooper. Tonight it is We Know Track and Field with Coach Gerald Richardson and also Coach Fred Rucker. We're excited. We have some great guests on tonight, as we always do on this show. And I want to take the time to say I am just lucky, blessed to have a relationship with these two coaches and to just listen to them on this podcast. It's been an inspiration to me and to a lot of the listeners. Last week, we had over 1,900 to listen live. So these gentlemen are on their way for sure and doing great things with some of our guests here. Coach Rucker, Coach Richardson, how are you?
I'm doing well, Princess. How are you doing?
Doing really good. Doing really good. Thank you. Coach Rucker?
Doing well, just like Coach Richardson.
Awesome, 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 for sure. All right, tonight we have Mr. Bob Beeman with us and Coach Norm Tate. I should mess that up. That's one of my favorites. And let's see who we have on the line, 4231. Who do we have?
It's Coach Tate.
Hey, Coach Tate, how are you?
Hiya, how I'm fine, and you?
Doing really good, sir.
Yeah,
doing really good.
A little tired. I just got back from Waco, Texas.
Oh, wow.
About 12:30 this afternoon, we were down in Baylor.
Track and field?
Yeah. Yes, we were running to meet at Baylor. Bad thing about it was that the weather was colder there than it was here. The meet actually was called yesterday before it was completed because of thunder and lightning. They had a couple of tornado warnings and stuff. So it didn't turn out as well as we thought it was going to be. We thought it was 90 degrees on Thursday, 3 Friday, and yesterday it was 48 and raining and thunder and lightning.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So
wow.
The races we win,
that you all are back safe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But and now I have some. Bob is going to call in a few minutes, but he's on the road, so he doesn't know how long. In fact, he asked me. I said, "Well, call in and explain your situation, and he may have time for a few questions and stuff." But he said he'd like to do it if you can set it up for another date. He's coming back from, he had a family situation in Albany, and he's on the way back from Albany. So he's going to call on to explain that he probably won't be able to stay on the call and stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
I told him to call in, and he got time for a few questions. But he said he'd like to do it. If we can do it another time with him, he has no problem with that.
Okay, well, Coach Richardson and Coach Rucker, I'll let you all chop it up with Coach Tate. And then as soon as Mr. Beeman gets in the system, I'll let you all know, and we can keep him on for as long as he can, and then we'll keep going, okay?
All right.
Okay.
What I wanted to say, it's a small world. Coach Tate, Coach Richardson, and myself, mm-hmm. you know, we're good friends. Well, remember our host or our guest last week, Lamont Smith? Well, Norm
yeah.
Tate and Lamont Smith were together at Baylor this past couple of days.
That's right.
Wow. Get out of here.
Yeah, in fact, we're topping it up, told him getting ready for next week for Penn Relays. He said he'll be there. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a small world, and I think that speaks a lot about the sport of track and field, because you can, you know, be friends and be competitors at the same time, and you can form relationships that last a long time. And Coach Tate and Lamont, Coach Smith, as you call them, they sent me a few pictures from yesterday, and they were in jackets, and they were bundled up.
You know? No, it was cold and raining. It was cold and raining. In fact, I got a chance to meet Lamont's son, too, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Small world.
And the other thing about it is my son and Lamont ran against each other in high school.
Well, I don't know if I even knew that.
Yeah. You remember Patrick McGlashan?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, he ran against Gerald in the hurdles. Yeah, that's my son.
Yeah.
We sat
together at your birthday party.
That's right. But he was running when Lamont was at William Brown and Gerald. And, yeah, he ran against Gerard.
Gerard.
In the 400 hurdles. Yeah. Right. He took in the States. He took third. It was Gerard. What's his name from Eastern? Remember?
Bill Mosley.
Yeah, they took 1, 2, 3. Gerard won it. Bill from Eastern was second, and Patrick was third in the 400 hurdles in that meet. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's good.
Small world is a bond of friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're still excited about the show tonight, even though we're gonna have a disjointed show, but we're gonna continue on. And I'm excited to have my co-host, as he likes to be called, my wingman, on the show. I couldn't do it without him. So, we're gonna continue on. And any of those who are listening in on the show right now in the second hour, we will take some callers to ask questions to our guests. But before we do all that, we're going to continue on and just, you know, keep talking to Coach Tate and just kind of get a feel for what he's got coming up. I know he mentioned earlier about the pin relays. Coach Tate, and before we get into that, there's been some callers that may be calling in today that may not know about your story. Give them a brief, if you will, introduction about yourself and why we're here today.
Okay. My name is Norm Tate. Everybody calls me Coach Tate now, but as an athlete, I was Norm. In fact, some reporter shortened my name when I was in college because my name is Norman, but everybody thinks it's Norm. Newspapers always said Norm Tate from North Carolina Central. So everybody knew me then as Norm Tate, not Norman. And now everybody knows me as Coach Tate. But I was outstanding athlete at pin relays in 1964, anchored two sprint teams to the Championship of America and in the 4x1 and 4x2, and I won long jump and triple jump. I'm third on the all-time list at pin as far as watches. I have 14 pin relay watches. And I was a six-time national champion, 3 in the long jump and 3 in the triple jump. And I was a member of the 1968 Olympic team in Mexico City. And I was hoping that two of my teammates could be on. Carlos, I haven't been able to get in touch with him for the last 2 weeks. He's everywhere. And Bob, he's going to try to call in and just explain his situation briefly. He had a family situation in Albany, and he's on his way back from Albany now. I spoke to him about 15 minutes ago, so he's going to try to call in while he's on the road. As a coach, I coached Jack Pierce, who was bronze medalist in Barcelona in the 92 Olympics and two-time silver medalist in the World Championships. And I've worked with quite a few of the various athletes in South Jersey that happened to be in the South Jersey Track Hall of Fame, French Sharp, Kerry Bavette, Jack Pierce is in the hall, Sutan Tucker. And I've been at Rowan for the past 16 years. This is my 16th year assistant coach at Rowan. I've had 5 national NCAA championship 4x4 relay teams and 3 individual champions and one in the 400 hurdles and one in the 60 indoors and and won 10 hurdles outdoors. This year I'm hoping for, you know, a few more victories. We have a pretty good team in the 4x1 and 4x4 and outstanding individual that went to Kingsway, Evan Cochran. He looks like he's going to be my next individual national champion. That's my story as far as my athletic career and my coaching career.
Yeah. Coach Pate, you mentioned Carlos and also Beeman. How did you guys meet? Was it through competition or how did you guys meet?
Very interesting. I'll start with John. 1964, when I was outstanding athlete, I was on the infield, and this gentleman came up to me on the field, and he was the East Coast representative for Puma. Puma had just started getting involved in track, and the guy approached me about, you know, wearing, you know, Puma shoes, and so we sat and talked for a while. His name was Lee Stock. And he took my school address down, and the next week I had about 10 pair of shoes and some uniforms, Puma outfits and stuff was shipped to me at school. And he said, when you come home during the summer, you know, come see me. Puma headquarters, the East Coast headquarters, was in New York City at the time. And I went over to New York one day, called Lee and told him I was coming over. And Lee said, I have a young man I want to introduce him to you. He's a up-and-coming high school track athlete in New York. And he was working. It was summer of 64. And he went to the back where they, you know, near stock area. And he came back with this guy. And looking like a thug, and you know, had his little bop going and stuff, and he introduced him to me. He said, "This is John Carlos. Meet Norm Tate." And we talked for about 15-20 minutes, and basically, I told him, you know, he had just won the city PSAL city champs in the 100, and even then. Anybody knows Carlos. Carlos is one of the type of guys that just, you know, he talked a whole lot of junk. And he was talking junk from day one. Little did I know at that time that this high school kid was going to be my teammate eventually in the Olympics, and that he also was going to become one of the top sprinters in the world. And that's how I met John Carlos. Working in the stock room that summer for Puma, and Beeman Bob, I met Bob my senior year in college. I was warming up at Franklin Field for the college triple jump championship, and the high school triple jump was going on at the same was at that time I was warming up, and the college jump was going to start after the high school triple jump finished. Larry Ellis, who eventually became the coach at Princeton, was the coach at Andrew Jackson High School. And Larry came over to me, and I knew Larry from New York Pioneer Club. And Larry said, I have this kid I'm coaching, and this is, I think, the third time that Larry said, this is the third time that I put him in triple jump. He's a long jumper. He had jumped like 24 feet in the long jump plus. And at the time, Penn Relay didn't have a high school long jump. They had a high school triple jump championship. And he said, I want you to take a look at him and if there's any pointers you can give him. He introduced me to Bob. And I'm looking at this kid about 6 feet tall, gangly, skinny kid, come down the runway, and he took a big hop, a short step, and a jump. And the only thing I could tell Larry was, well, tell him to see if he can hold his step phase a little longer. The next jump on the runway, Beeman came down the runway, took a big hop like he did before. His step phase wasn't that much better than the previous jump, but then he got a good jump at the end. He set the national high school record that day in the triple jump in pin relays his senior year. The only thing I could tell Larry Ellis at that point was, listen, forget about the triple jump. Let him keep long jumping. But I could see then, you could see that the kid had, he was raw. He was all over the place running down, but he could jump.
Yeah.
He could jump. You could see that from the very beginning. And I was hoping, that, and I hope he gets on at some point before we get off, because talent-wise, he's probably the best long – well, when he set that record, it sort of proved that at that time he was the best long jumper in the world. He just had that jumping ability. You know, some kids you have to teach them how to jump. He could just jump. As raw as he was, you could see that he could jump. And anyone that's ever seen that film of that 29-foot-2 jump in Mexico, it looked like he was as almost as high as the stadium in the jump. You know, he could just jump. What he lacked in skill, he made up for it in just innate natural ability. He could just jump. Tell you another story about Bob. Bob started at, in fact, my coach, Dr. Walker, was recruiting him. And but he ended up going to North Carolina A&T. And I had graduated his freshman year. I graduated.
Hey, coaches,
before
I hate
he
to
started.
Interrupt, but I think Coach Mr. Beeman is on. So
oh, okay.
Let's see if we can.
Great.
Let's.
Yeah.
Mr. Beeman, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Great. I have a few minutes. I'm in the midst of traveling, so I'm
well, thank you.
Very
thank
excited
you.
To be on with. Very excited to be on with Norm.
All right, awesome. Norm Tate is on. Fred Rucker,
yeah.
Gerald Richardson. You guys continue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bob. This
yes,
is Norm.
Sir.
I was just
hey,
telling
Norm.
About the first time we met when Larry, your high school coach. And I was telling him, you know, the same Larry Ellis that became coach at Princeton came over to me and asked me if I had any pointers I could give you to you know, to let him know. And I told him the first time I seen you jump, you had this big hop, little baby step, and a big jump. And I told Larry that, well, the only thing I can tell you at this point, because it was in the midst of you competing, I said, tell him to see if he can hold his step phase a little longer. And I told him you came down the runway on one of your next jumps and set a national high school record and stuff, you know. And I told him, I said, I remember telling Larry, well, don't have him triple jumping no more. Just let him stay with the long jump. Because I could see then that you just a super talent, you know. But I'll let these guys shoot some questions at you as long as you can stay on, and I'll just
okay.
add in some stuff that I know about you and stuff.
Mr. Beeman, pleasure again to have you on the show. I'll let my co-host, wingman, Mr. Rucker, ask you the first question, and thank you for calling in.
Thank you again for being on the show. But all of us, we have a beginning. Could you tell us who influenced you, who got you involved in track and field, and maybe even better yet, were you involved in any other sports before you got into track and field? How did you get started in athletics, I guess, is my question.
You know, basically, I think one of the most inexpensive sports during my time growing up was probably track and field. You know, I couldn't afford to buy any outfits or sweats or anything like that, but somebody would always have a pair of track shoes or lend me their basketball, because basketball was probably my number one interest in sports. And so it was all about somebody lending me something, lending me a pair of track shoes or lending me a basketball. And those, to me, were the most inexpensive sports. I didn't have an outfit or shorts or and even as they call it, a jock strap at the time. So, as a matter of fact, I didn't even know what that was growing up. So, but to be involved in some kind of form of track and field, I was pretty excited about it. I tried everything from the mile to the 100. Unfortunately, everybody was better than I was, and was were faster than I was. I thought I was fast, but there was always somebody faster than me. So I tried basketball, and then there was somebody always better than me in basketball and scored more points than me. But that it was a little bit more exciting for me in basketball because, you know, as I said, I tried anything from a mile or 15, it wasn't a 1500 meters, it was a mile run. And the 800 or the 400 and the 200, all those and the 100 were all too fast for me. So I was going back and forth. I'd never tried anything in the field event until one day one of the athletes got sick, and I borrowed his track shoes to do the long jump. I think I was about a good 12 years old, 11 years old, and you know, I jumped. For the first time, you know, I jumped about 19 or 20 feet, something like that. And actually won.
Oh, my gosh.
And then probably a year later, at 14, I think I was 14 or 15, we had the Junior Olympics at Randall's Island, and I jumped 24 feet. So there was some interest in continuing. You know, I love getting a medal, and I would pin the medal on the back of my hat and walk around the school, and the girls really like to see those medals, so that was an easy way of getting a medal. I mean, getting a girlfriend. So it was all pretty much innocent and somewhat naive of how to be consistent and how to really plan and get yourself ready for a particular event or sport. So it was pretty novice to me. So I just made a lot of blundering mistakes and stuff like this. And then, but I think that when I jumped 24 feet, I think that they became people in the community became more interested and said, you know, this kid has got he's showing some talent and stuff like this. Yeah, let's try to work with him and keep him going. And as I developed along the way, I didn't get better until my junior year in high school, and that really changed my whole thoughts about track and field. my sophomore year in high school, I came in as the guy that was going to do wonders in the long jump. And someone beat me in the long jump. And I think I had a bad year because I came in with 24 feet and then I went back to 23 feet. So I was very disappointed in that. And but the interest was that there were some guys that I had competed against in the PSAL or the PAL track meets that I wanted to beat. And it kept me stimulated and interest of beating these guys. And in my junior year in high school, I jumped 25.6 and jumped over 50 feet. I think I jumped 50 feet, 8, somewhere around there at the California High School Nationals or something. It was a real incredible awakening for me. So I stuck with more track and field than basketball at the time. And I moved forward, and the story is that, you know, I got a little bit better and a little bit better. And but the thing that how I met Norm was through Dr. Walker, Leroy Walker, who was actually the only coach that actually came to my home in South Jamaica to recruit me to come to North Carolina Central. And I had been following this this track and field magazine called Track and Field News. And Norman was in the magazine as a promising athlete. It wasn't the triple jump, it was in the long jump. And Dr. Walker said, you'll join Norman Tate in the as a long jumper at the university. And he had jumped either 25 or 26 something. And I said, man, I don't want to go there and jump against Norman. Man, he jumped too far. I don't want to jump against this guy. I'm afraid of this guy, man. And out of all the people in long jumping, including Val Boston, I never wanted to jump against Norman. Norman was very talented in a couple of areas, also running on the 4x100 and the 4x2. And my understanding was that the coach, Dr. Walker, did not play out there. And when he talked about coaching, he was there 24/7, and you had to finish your workouts. And he would say that, well, if you think that you're trying to get away with not finishing, well, we got all day and all night. I'll be out here with my chair, and we'll have you finish. So it was a lot of little small things that kept me away from North Carolina Central. But basically with Norm, because Norm was I think was probably, if not first place or second place, as a college athlete, to possibly make the Olympic team. And so it was quite an interesting transition for me to even turn down a scholarship offer to North Carolina Central. And I tell you one story that was very interesting to me. So all my friends were telling me that, you know, now that you have all the colleges after you, to make kids to go to their schools, make sure you get a car, make sure you get money and a house and all of this kind of stuff. So I was saying, yeah, I'm going to wait for that. And so everybody was sending these little letters to the house and all of that. And then, but Dr. Walker came to my house. He said, I'm coming to your house. And so I said, well, probably the big one. He's probably going to give me a house and a car and a wardrobe and all of that kind of stuff. So when he got to the house, he said, he walked in, and I was in an apartment with my grandmother, and actually she wasn't even home at the time. And he came into the to the home and to our house, sat down on the, and I said, this is my time to. Now he's going to ask me, you know, what kind of house I want and all this here. So he said, Bob, what we're going to offer you at North Carolina Central is 4 years of education. I said,
right.
I mean, in my mind, I was like, whoa, he came all the way down here to tell me he's going to give me 4 years of education. That's it. I mean, out my mind was blown. I mean, I felt like, wow, man. All my friends told me, man, you get money, man, when you go to college, man. You know? And so, but the interesting thing was Dr. Walker was right on the money. What you get is 4 years of education, and it's an experience that you'll never forget. And I was like, I don't know. I can't do it. I can't get 4 years of education because I don't know anything about education. You know, I was just out there, man, as a youngster, trying to be important, and got my feelings hurt, and the result was that I went to A&T, and there was no coach there hardly, so I was like, whoa, man, this, what am I going to do? So, but anyway, that was quite an experience, and I think that today I missed out on an incredible opportunity with Dr. Walker, but also to even have the opportunity to participate in practice and get better with other athletes that were even greater than me that were attending North Carolina Central. So that was a miss for me. And but I kind of tell everybody today that I was kind of glad that I didn't go to North Carolina Central. I didn't want to compete against Norm in the triple jump. But the thing about it was, I did not know that Norm was had that ability in the triple jump. And when the Olympic trials came around, Norm was in the triple jump. But I think that Norm got hurt, if I'm not mistaken. I think that he had a problem with your stomach. I think he had messed up your stomach or something like that.
Yeah, I torn my stomach.
And, I think he tore it or something like that, and it kept me out. But when we were training and getting ready for the Olympic trials, Norm was in the triple jump. I said, thank God he's in the triple jump, not in the long jump. So it was kind of, you know, so it was really interesting that I was more afraid of Norm than I was of Ralph Boston. And maybe that's because I would see more of Norman, because Norman was at North Carolina Central. I was at A&T. But it was quite an experience, man, to know when I tell the story that you know, my feeling about Norm was probably the biggest of all, and most concerning for me was Norman. So But I'm really thankful that he made the team as a triple jumper. I kind of wish that he had jumped the cheers a little bit further and all that kind of stuff in the triple jump. And but, you know, I came out looking somewhat I guess I did pretty well in the long jump in Mexico City. But the thing about it was that
pretty well.
To see Norm do some to be in the triple jump was quite interesting, because I had no idea that Norm was a double threat, in a sense that he would make the Olympic team in the triple jump. But I said, thank God he wasn't in the long jump. So, so anyway, that's my little story about coming along in college. And a lot of people might laugh about it, but I was pretty dead on serious about how great he was. And I think Norm would probably have been number one in the long jump. I think at that time, Clarence Robinson and you were probably the big threat in college.
Top two, and, right. Mm-hmm.
In college. And so I don't know. I just thought that that was probably one of my big stories of going into college, and then later on breaking the record in the long jump.
Yeah.
Did you end up going to UTEP before you went to A&T?
No, A&T was my first, as I was a freshman at A&T.
Okay.
And actually, I had a pretty decent. I think I won the CIAA our conference championship in the long and the triple. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I was like probably looking. I think the only person that was left in at North Carolina Central was Edwin Roberts. I think
mm-hmm.
I got him in his senior year, and mm-hmm. Everybody would say, "Hey, man, you better try to run. You should run the 100 against Edwin Roberts." I don't want to run against Edwin Roberts.
Yeah.
These guys, man, are too fast for me. But that's the kind of team that I think North Carolina Central had. They had athletes that had the potential to do just about any event. From the 400 down in relays, and long jump, and hurdles, and things like that. So, I think Norm was in good hands. So, I would say right about now that. Because we had such a great, coach, man. No doubt about mm-hmm. it that he would make the Olympic team. Mm-hmm.
Okay, real quick, Norm, just one question before I'll let you comment. But you know, the advertising was the 68 team was probably one of the best assembled mm-hmm. Olympic teams in history. And you guys have seen Olympics after your Olympic year. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think that team was probably the best ever, or is there a team that can match up to you? Norm, you could talk about that.
I think it's probably, and no doubt that the 68 team break records just about in every event we came on with a gold, a silver, or a bronze. And so I think that's both men and women teams. Mm-hmm. So I was amongst those other athletes that were winners of golds and silver and bronze. As a matter of fact, I think that Edwin Roberts came in fourth place in the 200 meters.
Mm-hmm.
United States came in first and third. I think it was Tommy Schmidt, John John came in. Mm-hmm. He had the 400, and it was Lee Evans, Larry James, and Ron Freeman.
Ron Freeman.
And Ron mm-hmm. Freeman was not really an athlete that should have been on the 400 meter individual.
Right.
I think Benson Matthews was probably mm-hmm. The competition between Larry James and Lee Evans.
Lee.
And I think that mm-hmm. the record would probably have been probably about 43-3. And also Tommy Smith, I think Tommy Smith probably could have ran a 43 flat or 42 something. I mean, it was an incredible team in terms of being talented in multiple sports. I mean, if, for example, if Norm had gotten hurt, they could have switched me over, and I could have said, well, if y'all want some points, man, maybe I could go 50 feet at least, or 52 feet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just so talented, man. And John Carlos could have been in the 100 meters. And, I mean, mm-hmm. it was just so many talented people that it was – you could have put together a 4x1 with probably a person that runs throws in the shot put, put him on one of the legs, and put three other people on there, and you would run on the 40 some seconds. So it was, again, we're talking about
my goodness
talent. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to interject one thing. Bob downgrades his sprinting ability a little bit because I remember his freshman year, they had a meet at Duke called the WTVD. That was the radio station, TV station in Durham. They had a meet at Duke, and Bob's freshman year, he won the 100 meters. At Duke as a freshman. I think he ran around 9.3 or something. So he was a pretty good sprinter also. You know, he wants to downplay his speed, but it didn't look like he was running fast, but he was. So he was talented
in
other areas.
Yeah, it wasn't nowhere near you guys, man. You guys were running sprints every day, man. I couldn't help that.
Yeah, but yeah, you could have held your own nose. You could have held your own. Hey, I saw you and stuff, you know. But the story I want to tell, so the audience can hear, when Bob set that record in Mexico. It was the first Olympic Games where they used that automatic eye for the measure jumps. And Bob jumped past where they had the board set. And it took them about 20 minutes to a half an hour to measure that jump to make it official because they didn't have any tapes on hand. They were using the board because no one expected someone to exceed, I think it was, must have been set at about 28 feet. And Bob jumped beyond that. So they had to find a steel tape to measure it to make it an official jump. So it took about a good 20 minutes at least before the jump was actually measured. And in the process of them, you know, looking for the tape to measure the jump, Lee Evans broke the world record, and people really didn't even realize at the time that Lee had broken the record because all of the confusion was around them trying to find a tape to measure Bob's jump. And Bob didn't even know how far he had jumped. some people may have seen the scene where Ralph Boston walks over to him and basically told him that he had jumped 29 feet, and you see Bob actually collapse on the field and stuff. I'll never forget that scene. Bob and another one of our good friends, Charlie Mays, was standing there with Ralph when Ralph, he was
Ralph was the authority on the metric measurement at the time, you know, because I remember when they were measuring in metrics that a lot of times when they say eight something, I didn't even know how far, you know, it was and stuff, you know, because we were used to, be, you know, the measurement being in feet and inches. So when Ralph basically told Bob he had just jumped 29 feet something, and Bob literally collapsed right there on the infield. And so, you know, it was just amazing. And I was fortunate enough to be in the stands and see the jump. And I knew it was far. I didn't know how far it was. But I knew he had jumped beyond that measurement board that they had at the Olympic Games.
I guess one of the big debates has always been jumping in below sea level, what's your thought about that? Was that an impact on the jump, or did it matter if he was above sea level or under sea level?
Well, in my opinion, I don't think sea level had anything to do with it. It was that once in a lifetime thing that happens in athletics, that where something happens that's just amazing and off the charts. And I think it would have happened. You know, I've always believed that people do things when they're supposed to do it. You know, at a particular time, and that was just the time that somebody jumped that far, regardless of it being at sea level. Bob had been jumping great prior to that, you know, not 29 feet, but he had been, you could see that every time Bob jumped that it was a long jump, even though it was in the, you know, 27-foot range. It's just that every time he jumped, you looked for it to be a great jump, and then that one particular jump, he put it all together, and that's what came about, you know, 29 feet 2 inches, you know,
and a quarter. Give that quarter. Eight
890. I remember the metric measurement 890. It was like wow and stuff. And tell you another story with that, Ralph, and what was Bob? What was the jumper from Great Britain? Lynn Davies. They literally not Lynn. Terry
Lynn Davies.
Ralph. Yeah,
oh,
but
Igor.
Lynn Davies
Igor.
Was the British, but Igor and Ralph literally sat there and said, "Gee, man, we jumping for second place," and so because in their minds, they knew that they weren't capable of jumping that far. You know, that's how amazing the jump was that the other competitors literally conceded first place after that jump. That was their mindset. I mean, Ralph, to this day, you know, God rest his soul, Ralph said that when he landed and they measured the jump, when they finally were able to measure the jump, Ralph said that him and Igor literally conceded first place. Because in their mind, they knew that they couldn't jump that far. It was just an amazing feat that took place that day.
Yeah.
And I think it would have happened that whether it was at sea level or altitude, as you know, as they say. It was just meant to be for him, for Bob to be able to accomplish that feat that day.
Coach K, doing a little research about your buddy, Mr. Beeman, I didn't realize that his jump of 29, 2.5 inches is still the Olympic record.
It's still the Olympic record.
Yeah, it's still the Olympic
and
record.
At the time, he broke the record by almost 2 feet.
The world record,
which is in field events, is amazing in itself. Because they set records on by inches and stuff, mm-hmm. not feet, you know.
Right.
Like I said, you know, I was able to witness Bob's jump and Mike Powell's jump. Mike Powell's jump, it was more competitive, and you had to jump that far that day because the battle was between him and Carl. Mm-hmm. Bob's jump, there was no battle at all. Mm-hmm. I think Bob was I'm not sure, but I think you was the first jumper in the finals, right?
I was the first American jumper.
Jumper in the finals.
I think I was the third jump.
Jumper.
I was the third jumper. But so when I jumped on the first jump, right after I jumped, it started raining.
That's right. I remember. Every day it was during the Olympics was during the monsoon season in Mexico. And at some time during the day, it would start raining and the streets would actually flood out in places. And when Bob jumped, after the jump, it started pouring down rain.
Right.
And everybody
and I was saying, I had to jump in the rain.
Wow.
And Ralph, and the thing about it, Ralph hated jumping in bad weather.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
Ralph literally conceded place and then ended up second because he got the bronze medal and stuff. Davies got the silver medal. Yeah.
No, it was Klaus Beard from East Germany. He got the silver. Ralph said there was one thing that I want to do is that I want to beat Lynn Davies every time
mm-hmm.
I get a chance, every time I jump against him because he had lost in Tokyo. Lynn had beat him and won the gold in Tokyo. And he said, I will never let Lynn beat me again. So Ralph was determined.
Webster created a new word after that jump. And they created a new word, beaminess.
Yeah,
I was going to ask that question.
That word came from Bob's jump. And so, you know, they added that to the dictionary.
Mr. Beeman, tell me about you talked about playing basketball, but I read something where in 1969 you were drafted to the NBA by the Phoenix Suns.
It wasn't a number one priority for me. In terms of how aggressive I was in comparison with, you know, comparing the two sports, track and field and then basketball. At one time, basketball was top priority. And because I had broken the long jump record, I became probably complacent or probably not as excited as I usually would be. And I did go into camp with ABA, and that's where I said that I would not go forward and try out for basketball. Yes, I was drafted by Phoenix Suns in the 15th round, 12th round or something like that. I played against some great athletes in basketball, but I think that the Olympics, for me, and in track and field probably made me more excited about track and field than it was basketball. But again, basketball was a sport that I really loved. And it's just unfortunate that it's long jump happened first before basketball. I don't think that I would have been the greatest basketball player of all time in 1968. You had Wilt Chamberlain, you had Bill Russell, you had all of these.
Okay.
All of these incredible athletes in basketball. So they had Bob Cousy. I would have probably been, you know, maybe a interesting player in basketball. But my interest became more interested in other opportunities in not only in sports, but I had to go back and finish college and all of that. So.
Yeah.
I had some things that I had to finish up.
Question, Bob. Didn't you? Because you finished at Adelphi, right?
Yes, I did.
And didn't you? Didn't you lead the conference in rebounding? At Adelphi that year? See, I know some stuff about you.
I remember.
Okay.
He led the conference in rebounding that year. He was at Adelphi finishing up. So, He has some talent now. He's down.
No doubt about it.
Gentlemen, I have a question for both of you guys. You know, with today, athletes can make some money in various sports. And, you know, it's baseball, basketball, and so on. But back then, when you guys were coming up, did you guys ever think or focus or even dream of becoming a member of the Olympic team? When you guys were competing in high school and college, was that ever a dream, or it just kind of happened?
It was a dream for me, Fred. My senior year in high school, you know, when you graduate and you have all the little stuff under your picture and stuff in your yearbook. And well, one of my statements under my picture of my senior year was that I was going to be in the Olympics. So it was a dream. I didn't know if it was going to ever happen. And you know, to make the Olympic team then, it was tough. I mean, you know, today all you have to do to go to the Olympic trials in the United States is all you got to do is meet the standard, and you can compete in the trials. Back then, I remember we had two trials that year. We had a trial in L.A., and then they took the top 16 athletes to Tahoe, and you had the second trial, which was to make the team. So it was tough to even get into trials. Now all you have to do, whatever the standard is, they call the A standard and the B standard. All you had to do was meet the standard. You could compete in the trials. Back then, some guys that were good didn't even make it to the trials because they select the top 16 and they go to the trials and then compete to make the team. So it was a lot different. And, you know, I don't know how, you know, Bob's insight on it about, but for me, it was a dream. I just continued to work hard to make that dream a reality and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bob, did you ever dream about making the Olympic team, or it just kind of happened?
Well, I didn't know anything about the Olympics until the summer of 65. They had three incredible athletes come do a tour with some of the summer programs, which came they were scheduled to come to Jamaica High School to give a talk about the Olympics. Three were Donna DeVerona and Wilma Rudolph and Ralph Boston. And so that was the first time I ever heard of the Olympics between 64 and 65. So it was at that time, that was my first time hearing about it. I think what attracted me was that these guys, when they arrived at the school, they had these, they had the Olympic uniforms on, and it had AAU in the front, and then they had USA in the back.
USA in the back, that's right.
Yeah, and so every year after, you know, after that, every time I see Ralph, I say, Ralph, how do I get one of those uniforms? And he said, you got to work hard for it. You got to work hard for it. So, my first time competing in the national championships, I had the opportunity to meet. I was in high school, coming out of high school. That was my first time ever competing in the nationals. And so we were in San Diego, and I saw Ralph Boston, and I said, Ralph, came to my high school, and you were talking about the Olympics. I asked Ralph, I said, Ralph, can you give me one of your USA uniforms? you gotta work for this, buddy. I was like, oh wow, Ralph, man, you know that. I'll work hard for it, but I was like looking at him and looking at his uniform. I was like, man, if I could ever get one of those, man, I could walk around the community with a USA uniform. I get all the girls and all that. All, you know, I'd be famous.
gentlemen, we're going to open up the mic to some listeners in the second hour for a few questions. And I don't know if there's anyone on there yet, Princess, that has a question for our guests. I guess you're not there yet. But, we want to open
muted.
Up.
My apologies. Yeah, no call additional callers yet. I'll alert you if there are.
Okay. That's great. How about your I know Coach Tate talked about some childhood heroes he had growing up.
Mm-hmm.
How about you, Bob? Any childhood heroes that you looked up to as an athlete growing up?
I missed the question there because I couldn't hear it.
Any childhood heroes that you looked up to as an athlete? You know, another athlete or maybe childhood hero?
I was having actually some difficulty interested in sports. I was more interested in how to make a hustle in the streets it took a while to make that transition, and I was more or less interested in being a hustler because they always had money in their hand, and so I would say if I could have a lot of money in my hand, I would I'd rather be a hustler, you know. And I think Coach Ellis, my track coach, was very much aware of that because I came from a alternative school before I attended regular high school, and so I was having some problems and identifying myself of what I wanted, which direction I would go in. You know, they always described me as the guy that had one foot in the grave and one foot out. It was a crapshoot. You know, let's see where this guy's going. But it didn't look like he was going to be a athlete. He looked like he was going to probably spend more time behind being incarcerated or something like that, or probably even die. So it was a struggle for me to keep my mind entertained with sports, you know. But I could see a lot of potential in starting to make some money through hustling and gambling or whatever it might be, or even doing something even more dangerous, which would be selling drugs and doing all that kind of stuff, because it was right there in the community. So I was truly blessed to have an incredible high school coach, Larry Elvis, who understood where I was coming from, but also he understood how he could keep me, I wouldn't say entertained, but keep me excited about, you know, my ability to stay in the right lane of, which would be sports, and finish high school too. So I will always be happy that this man took that opportunity. But also, I think that there was another coach. I don't think he was a coach at Jamaica High, but he became a coach at the Delphi, which is Ron Basil, who was also a high school teacher of mine. So eventually, down the road, I'd love to take my hat off to Ron Basil, because when I lost my scholarship at University of Texas at El Paso, he stood very tall for me, man, and said, Bob, we want you to attend Adelphi. You don't have to run track. You don't have to do anything. We want you to concentrate on graduating from college. And I also am really blessed to have Ron Basil as a guy that was the guy that said, come on over, Bob. We would love to have you. And that was a period in my life where I could have taken a bad road and gone another direction. But, you know, thank you, Ron Basil.
Yeah, there's always a coach in our life. I was going to say, there's always either a teacher or a coach or somebody in our community that does impact our life greatly.
That's right.
And I'm glad to hear that that coach was there for you, Bob. Go ahead, Norm.
Bob, you want to elaborate a little bit on why you lost your scholarship at El Paso?
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask that question. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, somewhat around April of 68, we were competing in Austin, Texas Relays. And the unfortunate news that came in that Dr. King was assassinated. And so we decided that we were not going to attend the next meet that we were scheduled for BYU. Brigham Young, who had a practice in their religion, it was to be described as there was no place, I guess, in the religion that they practiced or for black people or whatever, as we interpreted. And we decided to boycott the game, the track meet. And the athletic director at University of Texas El Paso said, if you boycott the games, the BYU meet, you'll lose your scholarship. And as a result, we boycotted and we lost our scholarships. And that's where I want to say that Ron Basil really was the one that, in terms of getting education and all that, he grabbed me real quick and said, "Hey, man, come on over. We will, we'll let you go. We don't even want you to run track. We don't even want you to play basketball. Just want you to finish school. So, and that was prior to the Olympic Games. That was April of 68. And then, of course, there was another assassination of Bobby Kennedy that was killed, I think, in June of 68 in California. So it was a number of very interesting things, conflicts and things that were going on that began the awakening of black athletes protesting about the Olympic Games and all that. I mean, it was just a whole list of things that I think were changing not only sports but also the world. So we were very active as students in college, but we were also very aware of world politics and things like this. But because we were also protesting against the war in Vietnam and all this, you know, so it was a moment of change.
Norm,
I believe.
Yeah,
Norm, I got a question for you. At your birthday party, one of the guys that showed up, wasn't he from Texas El Paso? Maybe I'm wrong. I thought there was a guy from Texas that was telling them that they boycotted, and maybe I got the story wrong, but I thought there was a guy from Texas.
It may have been. I'm trying to think of who all was there now. Get my age and start forgetting.
Right.
I remember more stuff from back then than I do now.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But it could have been though. But I wanted Bob. I knew the story, and I wanted Bob to elaborate on it because, as he said, it was a time of change. And. And black athletes were very active. A lot of people aren't aware of just what the black athletes was going through it in 68 and 69 and stuff. Like I was telling somebody about John, when John came back to the Madison Square Garden in 69 to run. I mean, it was like 19,500 people in the garden booing when they announced his name. It was a time that the black athletes, not only were they trying to compete, but they were dealing with the everyday problems that existed in the United States. So there was a lot on their shoulders. You know, people aren't aware that we weren't just athletes, that we also were involved on the political side of racism in this country.
What a disappointing thing to hear, because you think sports should bring people together. They say the Olympics is the biggest sport venue that brings the world and people together from all nations.
Yeah. We had teammates. I mean, we had teammates. White teammates that actually didn't speak to us when we were training in Tahoe because of their feelings about the whole situation and stuff. So it was trying times, you know, as a black athlete, because they weren't just, you know, trying to participate and make the team. You had pressures, you know, internal pressures from the coaching staff. I'll say if it wasn't for Stan Wright being in Tahoe, you know, one of the coaches of the team, a lot of the black athletes probably wouldn't have been able to compete in the trials as well as they did, because we had managers. You know, I think Bob probably remember his name. One of the managers, Carl Resch, he had a habit of not even calling you by your name. He liked to use the term boy, you know, and you know, so it was a lot of pressure on the black athletes during that period of time, you know, just to go out and compete and just feel free about competing and stuff. Yeah.
It's funny because I was doing some research on John Carlos, and I remember reading, I can't think of the gentleman who placed second in the 200. He was from Australia.
Yeah, Peter Norman.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize this, that Peter Norman, when he went home, the Australian government didn't even recognize him.
That's right. Until his death.
Right.
I mean, he was basically blacklisted by his own country.
Right. Yeah. I didn't know that. And then in my research, it also said when they had the 2000 Sydney Olympics, they didn't even invite him to the ceremony. He wasn't included.
Yeah. And then, another fact is that John's first wife, Kim, committed suicide because of the hatred, you know, against John, and you know, couldn't get a job, and you know, the whole bit, you know, and his wife ended up committing suicide. It was just terrible times for a black athlete, you know, the pressures that they were under to compete and really enjoy what they were doing. You know,
Bob, I understand in El Paso they named the street after you. Is that true?
Yes. I was fortunate enough to get a street. Yes, indeed. I didn't even know about it. I was very happy to know that El Paso sort of be that way. So,
good.
I was very happy to get that honor. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. My only experiences with El Paso was when I was playing college football. We played down there, and a couple of my teammates, their biggest thing was to go over to Juarez.
Yeah, go across the bridge.
They wanted to go to Juarez.
I went across the bridge a few times too, Gerald.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man, we got back to the school that Tuesday because we stayed over and watched the Cowboys play. And one of our teammates that made the Cowboys, so we got back to school and it was about five of us. Coach called us down to the dome. And it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and the lights were out, and he calls in there, and there was one light on down by the center of the turf. And he said, get down there by the center of the turf and pick up the shirt. And we're like, what the heck is he talking about? So we get down there, pick up the shirt, and he says, put it on. And he put it on, and it said, Juarez Track Club. So we got stuck over to Juarez after a bed check. And we got back to the hotel around 5 a.m. I'm like, how? So we had stadium stairs for 3 days at 5 a.m. with the Warriors Track Club T-shirts on. So that's my only experience with El Paso.
Hey, gentlemen, I have an old-school question about track and field. In the sense that you have all these modern tracks and modern surfaces. And I'm thinking about the veteran coaches and parents and senior citizens such as ourselves, tell us a few stories and what it was like running on a cinder track. Because I think a lot of kids, the young kids listening, have no idea what a cinder track is. And I'm sure you guys got some stories or crazy things on how you dealt with running on a cinder track.
Well, my first experience was the first track meet I was in high school on the cinder track. I remember there was no starting blocks. And if you recall the film of the 1936 Olympics and you saw the runners digging holes and putting their feet down in the hole to start the race, that was my first experience on the cinder track. We had to dig holes to for your start. You know, it wasn't any blocks. And then when it did come about, they were using blocks. They had the longest nails on each end, and you had to hammer them. You know, nail. You had a mallet. You had to knock the nails down into the ground as far as you could, so that the blocks wouldn't slide back on the cinders. So these kids don't know anything about that, man. But some of the times that they ran on cinders was as fast as some of these guys are running today. It shows you the talent level of the athletes from the past. The story that I like to tell about Ralph is that we were sitting in the stands at the 2008 Olympic trials, Ralph and some of the Tiger Bells and stuff, and Ralph turned to me and said, "Norm," he said, "you know what?" He said, "we would have made this Olympic team. This was 2008. that's how good we were as compared to some of the athletes today. Is that we would have made the Olympic team in 2008 with the distances that we had jumped back then and stuff, you know.
Well, you guys were just that legendary. That's not sugarcoated. You were legendary for a reason. So we're not going to sugarcoat that. Bob, tell me about your coaching career. I know you coached at AIU for a while in 1977. How did that go for you?
Can you hang on a second?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah. He's driving, I think. Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
So, if you can ask Norm some more questions, because I'm right now getting ready.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. No worries.
Okay. Yeah. You're trying to get his phone
Coach
together.
Coach, I know these athletes today. They got their earbuds in, they're listening to music and stuff like that. What was your go-to group or song, if you did back then? If not, what would it be if you can do that?
I didn't have I tell you the thing we used, and this is so funny. I don't know if you remember the cartoon The Roadrunner.
Yeah.
We used to Saturday mornings, like even at Penn, we come to Philadelphia and we cut on the cartoons and try to find the Roadrunner. It was like the biggest thing. We was, you know, he was going beep beep zoom and stuff, and we were saying, "Yeah, we're going out here, we're gonna be like the Roadrunner today." And stuff,
all right,
you know.
All right.
Because we didn't know, you know, there was no portable radios and stuff, so we didn't have music to warm up by, and so we just went out there and did what we, you know, was trained to do, warm up well and then get our minds together as far as, you know, competing, and we went out and competed. So we didn't have any go-to songs that you say was the thing that you wanted to listen to get ready. It was just like being in high school. It was just more advanced and stuff, you know. From way back then, you just went out and warmed up and got your mind together that you was the best out there, and you go out and compete. But we did watch cartoons every Saturday morning on when we were on the way trip, and so, and we were always trying to find the Roadrunner cartoon. And
that's good.
We put our mind to it that we were going out there and beep beep zoom and stuff. You know, that was us.
I think that speaks to your mental preparation, because you were more locked in, as they say today, than some of these newer days athletes. You know,
one of Doc used to tell us that he said this sport is 45%. Physical preparation, 45% mental preparation, and then somebody would always ask, well, what's the other 10%, coach? And Doc would say, luck.
he would say
luck. And that's the way we prepared ourselves. We went, did the workouts that he had set up for us. And he always tell us that we were the best and stuff, you know, and that enabled us to compete on the level that we competed on. That when we went out on the field, we thought we were the best. And to the point that there was times when I'd go to a meet, and back then, you know, the big thing, like Bob said, you know, you got a medal and you felt good about it and stuff. You know, pin relays, you got a watch. So you wanted to be that watch winner. And going forward in the other meets like the national championships or the Olympic Invitation Track Meet, they always had these super prizes and stuff, you know. And you know, in your mind, you telling the competition, well, you better see what they're giving out for second place or third place because I'm winning this. And that was our mindset. That when we went out there, you were the best. And if you lost, you tell the competition, well, you'll see me next week. And you went out and got ready for the next meet and stuff. Because it was about Doc always said the best athlete out there is the best prepared one, and that's what we did. We prepared ourselves by practicing hard and just mentally thinking that when you went out there, you were the best, you know.
Hey, Norm, which kind of leads me to this question. Who were some of the best athletes, and this is kind of a loaded one, that you competed against, and who were some of the best athletes that you've seen over your career?
Okay. When in my competition days, I mean the long jump was loaded when I was competing. You had Ralph, you had Charlie Mays, you had Bob, you had this white kid, Darryl Horn, this other white kid, I can't think his name, it was from Oregon. But the long jump was like 5 and 6, 7 deep. This guy, Clarence Robinson, that Bob mentioned earlier, we were the top two guys on the collegiate level when I was in college. They had another jumper, Gail Hopkins. So the long jump was always loaded. And the triple jump was loaded. The sprints was loaded. To compete in the trials, you had to go through the national championship. Now, like this year, the Olympic trials is the nationals. But back then you had the national championships and you had to finish in the top, you know, 8 to even, you know, qualify to compete in the trials. And so every meet that you were in was a tough meet because the events was loaded. I mean, in the sprint, you had Carlos. You had 4 or 5 guys from San Jose State, Ronnie Ray Smith, okay, this one kid they had. Then you had Carlos, you had Tommy, you had Lee, you had Dick Stebbins from Grambling, you had Ray Sadler from Texas Southern. All the events were loaded back then. So every meet you were in, it wasn't, you couldn't let up. You know, they were highly competitive. Now athletes tend to avoid each other until certain meets and stuff, you know. Back then, you didn't avoid anybody. You wanted to be in the meet with the best whenever you could. And that, because it brought out the best in you. And but, you know, it's a lot different now. These guys, they select certain meets they're going to run in, or they don't want to run against a certain person until they have to. It wasn't like that when we were competing. And Bob would tell you, every time he jumped, he had to be on his A game because anybody in the competition could win if you weren't on your A game. and it was just, it was just different. The whole approach was different. I don't know if it's because now these guys are making big money and stuff to run in certain meets and stuff. We didn't have the big money because any money that you got was under the table because it was considered a pure amateur sport. And so you couldn't accept money. You couldn't be in commercials. In fact, if you ran track, you couldn't even get a job as a phys ed instructor back then if you were competing because they felt that you got the job because of you being involved in the sport. That's how strict the amateur rules were when we competed.
How did you survive?
Well, you worked. When I got out of college, I had to get a real job. A couple of years I was substitute teaching. And then I got a job at Camp Kilmer at the Job Corps Center as a counselor. And because of the way the schedule was, I was able to train around that. Now USATF, they work with companies that provide jobs for those athletes that aren't at the top level so that they can make a living. But we had to work because there wasn't any income from the sport, basically, that would allow you to live a decent lifestyle. You would make a USA team and go to Europe, and as a member of the team, you got $2 a day per diem.
What?
So guys sacrificed $2 a day. That was the rate.
Wow.
$2 a day. You got, if you made a USA team, we got like a stipend when we made the Olympic team. It was hardly nothing. If you made a USA team that went to compete in Europe against Russia or Germany, France, the per diem was $2 a day. There are guys that gave up their jobs. I'll tell you an interesting story. Oscar Moore, that was at rowing.
Mm-hmm.
Oscar lost his job because he went to the Olympics.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was choices that you had to make. My whole career, I was working because there wasn't money coming from track at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if you were on that level where the shoe company was giving you a nice little bit of change, but it was under the table, you couldn't tell anybody because it was a pure amateur sport. That's what it was considered to be, an amateur sport. In fact, that's where the AAU started, was Amateur Athletic Union. That was what the AAU stood for, was the Amateur Athletic Union. In fact, I'll tell you a story. I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1965, competed and won the long jump. And when I was there, it was the first time that they had used all-weather runway. The track was still a board track, but the runway they had it covered with artificial rubberized surface. A guy walked up to me when I was leaving the arena and said, "Ask me a question." He said, "How did you like that surface you were jumping on?" I said, "It was great. It was fast." 6 months later, I got called in by the Metropolitan AAU Association to a meeting. I'm sitting in there with all of these guys, rich white guys that was made up the Metropolitan Athletic Association board. And they took out a pamphlet and passed it around. And when the pamphlet got to me, down there, in quotes, it says, it was from this company, it was AstroTurf, from the company that was based in Australia, had this quote in mine in there that said, "This was the fastest surface I ever jumped off of." Do you know I was suspended for 6 months? Because they thought I took money.
Wow.
To make that statement. Yeah. I was suspended for 6 months of competition in 1969. After the Olympic Games, 1969, I had moved to New York, and I was running for New York Pioneer Club. And Mr. Yancey, who was the head of New York, he said, Norm, they want you to come to a meeting at the AU offices in Lower Manhattan. And when I walked into the room, that's what I had to face, questioning about me making that comment. It was in this company used my quote in their pamphlet as an advertisement. I made the quote. I said this was the fastest surface I'd ever jumped on, and they suspended me for 6 months. You know, they had to go on my word that I didn't even know anything about it, you know, the company or anything. But because that statement was in that pamphlet that I said it was the fastest surface I'd ever competed on, ever jumped on, they suspended me for 6 months in competition. And if any of us had ever told anybody that we was, you know, I got X amount of dollars, you know, from Puma or Adidas, whatever, you know, company gear I was wearing at the time, I would have been suspended. And in fact, Adidas had a booklet that they put out every year with all their new shoes in it. They would have pictures of the athletes in the various events, and they'd have the face would be blacked out, okay? But it would show their body and show them running 100 meters in Adidas. And their face would be blocked out, because if they had shown the athlete's face, that athlete would have been suspended, whether he took money or not. Mm-hmm. Because you couldn't advertise anything. You couldn't do anything, you know. And as an athlete, and I was a physical education major, I couldn't get a job as a physical education instructor because they said it would be because I was a athlete. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, that's how strict the AAU was at that time and stuff, you know.
All right, Norm, I'm going to put you on the spot here. So in your opinion, who are the top five long jumpers in America? Who are the GOAT long
ever?
Jumpers?
Ever. Okay,
Go from number five and go up to number one.
Okay, number five, I would say me.
Okay.
I would say I was in that top five in the U.S. Based on what I jumped and how consistent I was. I would say second.
Or number four?
I'm sorry, fourth would be what's his name from Georgia? I can't think of the kid's name. He's coaching now down in Georgia, but he was Olympic champ in 2000.
Myrick?
No, not Larry. Phillips is his last name. Is it Phillips? He's in Georgia now. Can't think his name. But then I would put Myrick's third. No, I reverse that. I would put Myrick's fourth, because I would have to go with Carl second. I would put Ralph Boston third. I would still put Bob Beamon at the top. Because Bob's career, basically, that Bob
Dwight Phillips. You mean Dwight Phillips?
Dwight Phillips was consistent and over a period of time. Ralph, I would put second, because Ralph was probably the most consistent long jumper of all, even more consistent than Carl. Ralph is the only jumper that's won all three medals. Ralph won gold, silver, and bronze in the Olympic Games, over three Olympics. Ralph won gold, silver, and bronze. He got We call it the hat trick. He got all three of them. Mike Powell, I would put Powell jumped farther than Bob, but I would rank Mike under Carl. You know, I would have Carl second, and I would have Carl second, Ralph Boston third, but I would still have Beeman at the top. Bob, I think with Bob, after he set the record, Bob had every other jumper ever after that trying to jump 29 feet. And it changed the whole mindset of jumpers, because instead of focusing on just being the best jumper they could be, after Bob's record, everybody was trying to jump 29 feet. And you can't have that kind of mindset.
Right.
Even Carl, to a certain extent, Carl wanted the world record so bad it was ridiculous. Every time Carl came down the runway, he was trying to jump farther than anybody had ever jumped. So it changed his mindset about jumping. And that's what happened with Beeman's jump. From that point on, everybody was trying to jump 29 feet. And it was a superhuman effort and stuff. But everybody after that was trying to be superhuman in that event. And it just doesn't happen that way, you know. Instead of focusing on just being the best jumper they could be at the time, every time they came down the runway, they was trying to jump 29 feet. So they were putting additional pressure on themselves as far as competing. And Carl will tell you, Carl was trying to break the world record every time he jumped. And it just doesn't happen that way. You know, records come just by you preparing to be the best, and you go out there and compete, and it may happen, it may not happen, but you can't, you know, be trying to break records every time you compete. And that was Carl's mindset. Powell was, I don't rank him over Carl, because Powell was so inconsistent. Mike was inconsistent as a jumper. And he had the ability, but he was just inconsistent. You know, he fouled a lot because I think his natural ability allowed him to jump as far as he did. Powell was a lot like Beeman physically, the speed and the talent that he had. He just didn't work as hard to perfect his technique and stuff like the other jumpers did. And in Tokyo, he just happened to hit that big one and stuff. Mm-hmm. Probably in Tokyo in 91 was probably the most consistent that he ever jumped in a series. You know, Powell would jump, have a good jump, and then have five bad ones. He just happened in that meet against Carl in 91, he just happened to, every jump he took was a good jump. But that was rare for him. But overall, I'd say Bob's jump, and every time Bob jumped, it was big jumps. Ralph was the most consistent. Ralph would jump 26, 27 feet every time he came down the runway. Bob wasn't as consistent. He just had more talent than anybody in the jump. Powell had that kind of a talent, but he wasn't as consistent. You know, but I would say I would be last in that top five. I was consistent at 27, you know, 26 feet. That's what enabled me to win those. I won three back-to-back national championships, all of them over 26, and one of them was, you know, 27 plus. I think my biggest downfall, and Dr. Walker said it, and Bob sort of, you know, hinted at it, was that I was doing both, and eventually they start, you know, taking away from each other, you know, by doing both long jump and triple. And the one thing Doc said was that he wished he had never taught me to triple jump, because I probably could have been the best long jumper consistently ever, because of my speed. I was faster than any of them in the jumps. I had the kind of speed that Carl had, and Carl will always tell you, and that's the way I always thought about it, was that I was a jumper that could sprint, you know.
Okay.
And that was Carl's philosophy also, and that he was a jumper that could sprint, and I was, you know, I was out of the same mold. In fact, Mr. Lewis told my son when he was young one time, we was at in Towson. Remember the meet they used to have, the youth meet at Towson?
Yeah, I did.
I introduced my son to Mr. Lewis, because my son growing up, my youngest, he always would imitate Carl running with high knees, hands open and stuff when he was young, you know. He would always imitate Carl. And so I introduced my son to Mr. Lewis down in Towson. He was 9 years old. And Mr. Lewis asked my son, he said, "Do you know who this guy is?" And my son looked at me and said, "Yeah, that's my dad." And Mr. Lewis said, "Well, your dad was the Carl Lewis in his day, because I was a jumper that could sprint." And I thought that was one of the greatest compliments that I ever received as an athlete, when Mr. Lewis told my son that. But technically, Carl wasn't the best jumper, technically, when you talk about technique. I always thought Larry Myers had the best technique as a jumper. He just didn't he didn't have the competitive mind that Carl had. I'll say that as a competitor, Carl to me was probably the best competitor in the sprints and jumps that I've ever seen. I sort of had his mindset. I didn't like losing. And Carl had, you could see that in him. He didn't like losing, and he was always prepared to sprint well and to jump well, you know. So I'd say, as the greatest competitor, I'd say Carl. As the best jumper I've seen naturally was Bob. He just could jump. Fred.
Yeah, on a light note, because I know we're running late into the show, I've always heard this story, and I'm not sure we talked about it before, that you had a nickname in college. Could you explain to the audience the nickname of Sugar and where that came from and how that came about?
Oh, yeah. you know, you was talking about cinder track. I ran at Penn up until 65 in school, they had a cinder track at Penn. And we used to pick up grass as you walked across to your zone. You took up handfuls of grass and you would spread it on the cinder. That was your check marks. And on a windy day at Penn, it was blowing, you know, grass, and check marks was all, you know, messed up and stuff, and barely visible sometime. In 65, when we came to Penn, there was this restaurant that Doc would take us to every year. We'd eat there every year off of Chestnut Street, and we'd have breakfast there before we come back to the hotel, change, and then go to the stadium. And that one time in 65, that Friday, that Saturday morning, we went in to eat, and they had these sugar jars on the table, that you pour the sugar into your spoon from the jar. And so I told the guys that ran second and third, and me, I said, take one of those sugar jars and put it in your bag. And they didn't even know why. I said, take a sugar jar. So when we got out on the street outside the restaurant, I said, we gonna use this sugar to put our check marks down on the track. And so when we went out there that Saturday in the finals of the 4x1 and 4x2, we walked across the field. Each one of us had that jar of sugar, and we spread the sugar down as our check marks, and they started calling me Sugar after that. The funny thing about it, when Doc found out, Coach was a person of, high standards, moral values, moral standards and stuff. He made us take them back that Sunday morning and stuff. And so he made us take the jars back to the restaurant and give them back to the waiter. There's one waiter used to wait on us all the time. We gave them back to him that Sunday morning. But we used the sugar to put our check mark down on the track instead of the grass and stuff. And so the guys started calling me Sugar. But that was sort of the creativity that we had back then. You found ways to accomplish what you needed to accomplish and stuff, some of the guys that was on that team, they still call me Sugar sometimes when they see me. Here comes Sugar. And so, in fact, the guy that Gerald met, Terry, when I acknowledged him, when I get Terry was one of them. He ran third leg on our relay and stuff. And sometimes to this day, he'll tell that story to people, because they don't believe it. I said, yeah, we used to pull up grass walking across the football field and spread it down as our check marks. Because, now we use tape or whatever and stuff. Yeah. But I guess, during those times, and Fred, you had to be creative with some of the stuff you did. And I sort of got the idea of the baby powder from that, Fred.
I copied your idea. And I use
it
to check marks too.
Yeah,
they used to cut tennis balls in half, and we use those as check marks.
Yeah. I mean, you had to be creative at some point in time. Let me tell you what I did last year at Penn. Mm-hmm. Remember it rained?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, we ran the 4x1. I gave each of the kids 4 thumbtacks. And because everybody was having a problem with the tape not sticking to the track because of the it's wet.
My kids
put thumbtacks on each end of their strip of tape, man, and pushed it down into the rubber on the track and pin. And mm-hmm. everybody sitting in the stands, they was like, hey, why aren't there tape, flying away and stuff? There was tape flying. The rain was. The tape was gone. Some guys was running the relay, and they was looking at their runner coming in. He gets this close, I'm going to take off because the tape wasn't there anymore. I gave the kids thumbtacks, and they put the thumbtacks down on the end of the tape, man. And so I said, you got to find a way. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And it's not in the rule book where it says you can't.
No, nothing in the rule book say you can't.
That's right.
Indoors, you can't put nothing down indoors, in like 4x2. Hey, I took 2 white thumbtacks and gave them to the guy and I said, just put this down and just walk over there, nonchalantly and put the thumbtack down. And you can see that thumb. You can see the head of that thumbtack. So when he gets to that point, you take off.
I did it at Ocean Breeze.
We ran 4x. When in fact, we set the national record last year at D3 at the Armory, and that's what I did. I gave the guys. I said, use this. The thumbtack is the goal mark, man. This stuff. Hey, we ran 125 in the Armory and set the D3 record last year. Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah, you have to be creative, man. This stuff.
Oh yeah,
but yeah. Did Bob get back on?
No, he did not. He ended the call, unfortunately.
But, yeah, because he said he at some point in time he'd love to do a whole show on stuff. He said he didn't know how long he'd be able to stay on. But
the goal is to get all three on again.
I can get John on here.
Yeah.
But Bob was a great guy. But Bob would tell anybody. I mean, the first time he told me, I was amazed that he was always glad not to see me in the long jump. He thought I was that good. I mean, that's the way he looked at me as a competitor. And I think that was one of my biggest assets is that I was a lot like Carl mindset wise. Mm-hmm. I didn't like losing, and I beat Bob. In fact, after the Olympic Games, Bob, I never lost to Bob again.
Wow.
In the long jump, but Doc used to always say, he said the worst thing I ever did was I learned the triple jump my freshman year in college because they didn't have it in Jersey. And Coach said it's one of the worst things that he thinks he ever did as far as me being a better long jumper than I was that he taught me how to triple jump, so I was always doing both in meets. But I was able to win at the Nationals. I won three straight long jump and triple jumps in the same day at the Indoor Nationals.
Norm, did you ever know that Dr. Walker was recruiting Bob when you were in college?
I knew. We was trying to get him. I mean, it was just, and I didn't, in my mind, when I, like I said, I saw him triple jump at Penn, really, and he set the national high school record that day. I knew that I was looking at greatness. But I didn't see it in the long jump. I saw him triple jump, and I was saying that he went 50 feet that day, 50 feet 8 or something. That was a national high school record at that time. He held it for about 3 months. I think it by the end of the school year, some kid from upstate New York had jumped a couple of inches further than him. But you could see the greatness in the person as an athlete. It was the same. What I saw in him is what Dr. Walker saw in me. But Doc, in his book, said that I was the greatest athlete that he had ever coached. But you could see that in Bob. He was raw, but he could just jump. And he downplayed his ability, and he wasn't a great shooter. But when he went to Adelphi that year, he didn't run track that last year when he finished at Adelphi, but he went out for the basketball team. He led the conference, whatever conference that Adelphi was in at the time. He led the conference in rebounding and stuff,
I didn't know he played basketball.
He wasn't a great scorer, but he was like a Dennis Rodman.
Okay. Gotcha.
He was like a Dennis Rodman type player. He wasn't a great scorer, but he could jump. He could jump out of the damn gym, man. I mean, he could just jump, man. And I mean, like I said, the first time I seen him, I told Larry, because I was thinking about triple jump at the time because I hadn't seen him long jump. I told Larry, I said, man, let him, hey, let him keep long jumping, man. keep him out of the triple jump. But I was looking at, as far as me, having it from later years. But I never knew until after we had both retired that he felt that way about me as a competitor in the long jump. Yeah, he told me we were together somewhere, and he was telling the people, he said, hey, this is the guy I feared more so than Ralph. I guess he saw the competitive in me, because every time we jumped against each other, it was like Powell and Carl jumping against each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a rivalry. And after he jumped the 29 feet in Mexico, it just made me more determined. And I never lost to him again in any competition in the long jump. I didn't jump 29 feet, but I didn't let him beat me. And so, yeah.
Hey,
but he, Coach Tate,
yeah. Yeah, Coach Tate, we're out of time. And, but anyhow, I just want to say thank you again and thank Bob again. And hopefully we can get all three legends on at one time.
Same time, yeah. Because that'll really be a show, especially if we can get John.
Yeah, it would be.
Hey, I tell you some John stories, man, that are unbelievable.
We'll save those for the next one.
This is very good.
Yeah.
I learned
Wingman. Wingman, as always, it's been my pleasure to co-host with you. And,
Gerald, I just want to say I like that picture you sent me, the three amigos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the picture we took at the Hall of Fame, at the Jersey Hall of Fame thing. I saw that.
Oh, yeah.
I said the three amigos. That was funny.
Yeah we'll have Coach Booker on next week. Well, he'll be in Coach Booker
next week.
Yeah. All right.
I'll definitely
listen. Princess, thanks again. I'll let you close it out.
Thank you so much, Coach Tate, Coach Richardson, Coach Rucker. It was awesome just listening to you all. And at some point, I'm going to have to call you Sugar, too. So, and thank you.
Okay.
All right. And a shout-out to Bob Beeman.
Let me tell you a real quick story. I had a girl on my track team in high school. And her name is Princess Cooper.
Wow.
Yeah, she's a lawyer now out in L.A., but she ran track for me in Hempstead High School. That's her name, Princess Cooper. And when I first saw your name on Facebook, I said, that really is her name, Princess Cooper. And that was this girl's name, Princess Cooper. She's from Hempstead Law and Order.
Here I thought I was the only princess out there. Yeah, I'm gonna have to.
Well, in my eyes, you are the only princess.
Oh. Thank you, Coach.
Okay. You're the
I
only
appreciate
princess.
You guys. That's amazing. Right. Everybody says you got a twin or somebody out there for sure that has your name will look like you for sure. Gentlemen, thank you. It was great spending some time with you on this Sunday, and we'll see you next week. And Coach Tate, we can't wait to get you back and get all three of you all together. I'm sure there'll be plenty of stories for sure. Coach Richardson and everyone's wingman, Coach Fred Rucker, we appreciate you. You're mine too. So you guys have a great week, okay?
All right.
We'll be back tomorrow at 6 p.m. with Duck Riley and Tim Moore and the crew. We're going to do our own NFL mock draft. But right now, we know track and field with Coach Rucker and Coach Richardson. And we had the guys on Bob Beeman and Norm Tate tonight. It was awesome. You can get this replay on Spotify and Apple iTunes and iHeartRadio tomorrow. Never Had It So Good. We'll see you next time.